go, because I'm not real clear on what you're doing. You're writing a book?
Well, yeah, although the bigger thing is I'm just trying to create an archive just while people are still around. What happened to the communes, you know? What went on there?
I'm doing it all electronically, archiving a lot of stuff, like Sender's book, Home Free Home.
Are you really? You're,
it's already on the book. It's already out there.
It's on the web?
Yeah.
Home Free Home is?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's on my website.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Well, I'll need to get that URL before I leave so I can look that up.
Well, it's actually not, like I said, the website's actually under construction, but the FTP site, which is the heart and backbone of the website, is Stevens, Stevens, @ sonic.net.
Okay. Stevens @ Okay. Stevens @ sonic.net /users. Yeah, well, that's great. I will take a look at it for sure. But we're interested in getting people's individual stories.
About what kind of stories?
Well,
about places.
Yeah, communal places. Yeah, and
I've been involved with lots of different intentional communities.
Have you really? Yeah.
Over the years, several.
Well, was Morningstar the first? It wrote, what before that?
Actually, the first true intentional community that I got involved with is in Ohio, and it wasn't a community per se, as it was a publication. I got involved with some folks in Ohio who did intentional community publications, and they were out of Brookville, Ohio.
Huh.
They were instrumental in networking intentional communities even in the late 50s, early 60s. And I got involved with those folks and helped them put their newsletter out.
Was that community service?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Huh. So you got involved way back then?
I got involved then, back in, 64.
Uh-huh.
64 is when I started my involvement with intentional.
So did you move to a community at that point?
No. Well, I moved to San Francisco and got inducted into one, you might say.
Yeah.
After that, in 67, I moved to San Francisco. And immediately got caught up into Peter Coyote and some of the other folks who were doing the diggers. I started being a digger at that point. Digger from the first part of 67 until the 70s.
Huh.
Digger trip, making digger bread, feeding people in the park, and providing crash pads, and opening free stores, and doing all that.
Hmm.
But then I got involved very early with the Rainbow Band, too.
Oh, you did?
And they had, the first intentional community I guess I was in was in San Francisco. It was the digger community. I mean, we all lived together in the same house, and we all worked for the same things, we were all doing different projects, and we all had jobs, but for the most part, we just lived there. The whole group lived on Belvedere Street. Belvedere, so that was really the first community living I had ever done, was there on Belvedere. But then I got involved with when the diggers came up and asked Lou Gottlieb about using his farm to raise vegetables, and it was a natural progression for me to move up to do that too. So in late 1967, a bunch of us came in and put in the 1968 harvest. I was actually late part of 67 to get the ground ready, and then in the set, or maybe 68 for the first harvest to come up with fruits and vegetables, and, you know, whatever it would take. So during the same time, a guy by the name of Barry Adams was out running around promoting this. Well, he didn't call it a rainbow family at that time, a rainbow guy. No, this was earlier. I'm sorry, I met him earlier. Must have been in 66. Must have met him in 66 because the first real rainbow gathering of sorts was on June 15th or June 23rd, 21st, that's it, June 21st, 1967, mm-hmm. at Boulder, Colorado, or just outside Boulder, mm-hmm. Colorado. First one. It wasn't called a rainbow gathering. It was called just a gathering of the tribes, is what it was called. They had somebody had predicted that on the equinox, California was going to fall into the ocean. That wasn't the reason for going. The reason for going was just to go to this huge party. So I got there and got involved in that whole end of it, procurement, doing basically the same stuff I did with Diggers. Go around to businesses and scrape up food and stuff. I've been in procurement areas for a long time. I sort of like Radar in the TV show or movie MASH. You need to get something done, go see it. Mm-hmm. So that was the basic thought of the Diggers to start with. Was you see a need that needs to be done, do it. Mm-hmm. That's where that started. So Rainbow Family, which wasn't a Rainbow Family at that time, sort of gathered in Boulder, Colorado in June of 1967. And then that summer, it was a summer of love, everybody migrated back to San Francisco. And then that fall, I went up and went up to Marble Mountain, Washington, where Rainbow Family, at that time, the headquarters of the Rainbow Family was at. became involved in that commune. That was a fairly small commune, 10 acres, but back 5 acres on the land bordered the Cascade National Forest. Mm-hmm. It was like having 10 billion acres.
Yeah.
So that was kind of nice.
And that was after Morningstar.
Well, I went to Morningstar on about 10 different occasions.
Oh, okay.
Stayed at one point or another. I don't know, you know, what exactly are you looking for? Are you looking for stories about Morningstar or stories about
any of Marble Mount? I've heard much more about Morningstar. Why can you tell me, what was Marble Mount like?
You never heard of Marble Mount?
I've heard of it, but I just haven't talked to anyone who's been there.
It's a beautiful house.
Where was it exactly?
It's on the Skagit River. It's right at the base of the. It's at the foot of the Cascades on the Skagit River, and that's north around Cedro Woolley, Washington.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. About. Yeah.
Well, it was Marble Mount is a town, a little tiny town. It had a grocery store and a gas station combination, post office. That was it. A little tiny town. Cedar Woolley was the nearest big town. Mount Baker was right there. It's right in Mount Baker National Forest, too. Anyway, Barry Plunker, Barry Adams, and same guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of a philosopher. He never lived anywhere for any length of time. He'd winter here or summer there. Whatever, but as for having a permanent location, he barely did. However, man was a master at bringing people together. He's a master organizer, and he does it by not organizing. That's the best way I can explain it. People naturally gravitated to him. It was a very charismatic man. A lot of the kids, him being a few years older and a little bit wiser and lot of the kids really looked up to him. You know, say, hey, this guy's really got his head screwed on straight. Let's take the trip. Well, basically, that's what happened to me. I met him around a campfire at Morningstar one time. Doug, where he was at, invited him to stay at my place in the city. And one thing led to another, and I finally moved to Morningstar. To Marble Mountain to see what the whole thing was about. So I moved to Marble Mountain, and we got there. It was August, I think. August. And the trees, are, all the berries were in bloom.
Yeah.
In full swing. And living was pretty easy there for the first 6 months or so. They had just bought the place. Gary Beck's dad had thrown some money at it or something. Julian Beck. He was still is. I don't know if he's still alive or not. He did that. He was
a living theater.
Yeah, he started with the living theater. I got a good story about that.
Yeah.
About the living theater, I got a great story.
Yeah, what's that?
When I was in San Francisco, the Diggers got a hold. Somehow, the Diggers got a hold of the Straight Theater for the last 3 weeks of its existence, and the Living Theater put on a show there the last day. Them and a group called the MC5, Motor City.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They were touring together or something. Anyway, they did a production of Paradise Lost. Milton's Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. Only they did it the way only the Living Theater could do it. Naked.
Yeah.
So that was a blow. It started the Hate Street riots. The Living Theater was scheduled to come in. The Diggers had said, okay, we'll throw open the doors and we'll do all this stuff. A group in town called the They called themselves White Panthers.
Oh, yeah.
The Good News Commune or the Good Something Commune. I forget what they were. Good Something. Right?
Good
Earth Commune.
Good Earth
Commune.
In San Francisco?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had a big house, and they were like, they walked around with berets on their heads. And, you know, they were kind of like hippie. Sort of like hippie, what do they call them guys that do it now? Back east. They ride the subways.
Oh, yeah. Guardian Angels.
They were sort of like the forefront hippie, hippie and Guardian Angels. They later ended up taking over the Berkeley Barb and turning it into something called the Berkeley Tribe.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
It was the same time. Pretty good sized group.
Good Earth Commune, huh?
Yeah, stuff like
and
that.
And they were in the city.
Okay. In a big house, I played. And anyway, at any rate, this group had volunteered. They were very revolutionary. They were politically active and extreme left wing, and they were pretty close to the bomb throwing idea you get when you think of anarchists. They were pretty right in there. They weren't afraid to use violence in any way. Manifested in many ways. At any rate, them and another group called San Francisco Newsery. I don't know if you've heard anything about that.
That was some kind of collective. I can't remember.
That was another collective.
Exactly. Yeah.
Another commune called Newsery had had archived all of these absolutely forbidden films. Films directly from the Newsery.
Really? Huh?
Straight from the Newsery. They came in on the boat and they went to the Newsery. Nobody else, they were too hot for anybody else to handle. You know, the bombing of Hanoi and everything that's going on there. Then the Good Earth Commune had made this movie called Off the Pig.
Newsreel people?
But they had made it with the Newsreel people. Yeah, called Off the Pig. And in that movie, the movie was basically a documentary about hippies arming themselves. And,
And after they armed themselves, there was a little shooting gallery or shooting range.
Yeah.
Where they would shoot. They dressed up a dummy like a cop and blew holes in.
Yeah.
So there was this newsreel. We decided not to show it in the theater. Instead, we showed it on the outside wall.
Yeah, I see.
While the Living Theater was going full tilt movie and MC5 was doing their number one hit called Off the Pigs.
Right? Yeah.
Then they did another one called Up Against the Wall Motherfucker.
Yeah.
It became very blue, very fast. Then I ended up with firebombs being thrown off the top of buildings in H Street. There's a lot of sound. But those are several communes. Do I have a what? Why do you need a dollar? How are you going to get... Didn't you already go down? There were lots of communes around. Cauliflower is probably the people who did the best network.
Well, they had that newsletter they passed out.
Right,
Cauliflower. Yeah.
I got into that too.
Did you? You were you that were there with Cauliflower for
a
while?
Yeah, I was one of the pastor outers. I did one of the communes. That was always a lot of fun. You always got a lot of food. You always got hard as hell.
Yeah. At Cauliflower.
Yeah. Well, I'm not at Rosenthal's place, but going around to the different communes and delivering the letters. It was all hand delivered. And they had these little boards that they made up with clothespins. And your new issue would be hand delivered every 2 weeks or month or whatever it was. They'd hand deliver this. We would hand deliver this. There was a whole bunch of other stuff that was going on at the time that nobody knew of. Totally. Yeah. I guess in the light of today, it would be a real smart thing to let people know actually what was going on, because there was a lot of underground shit happening that nobody had any conception of, because we kept quiet for the last 30 years. Really. We were heavily involved in the Diggers and Rainbow Fan and Morningstar Ranch, all in conjunction. were heavily involved in the transporting of deserters and draft dodgers from Oakland Production Center to Canada. We had an underground railroad going from Oakland to Canada. We would pick them up at the Oakland Production Center at 7 o'clock in the morning. We'd just go over and start saying, hey, if you don't want to go, you don't have to. We've got a way out. These guys are standing in line. Some of them came with us. We would take them over to the All Saints Church in San Francisco, outfit them for the journey, deposit them at Morningstar Ranch, the second leg, and then someone would pick them up there and carry them to Marble Mountain. And then we would walk them across the Cascades into camp on foot. And I would say we probably transported, that I know of, probably 400 to 500 boys.
Really?
Yeah. So that's one of the things, the underground things that was happening, that still there's not a whole lot of people talk about. I talk about it only because of Irving Rosen, because I think he deserves a spot in history for the way he helped. I know Irv's a Raven Queen. But there was always a spark in the man, that made you look past what you felt were his inequities to get right to the bottom of the guy and say, oh, I see what you're doing. What he was doing in the real sense. forging documents. Whatever we needed, social security cards, whatever we needed, birth certificates, whatever we needed, draft cards, everything.
To help these deserters and stuff.
Right down the line.
Yeah.
Best paper you've ever seen. Yeah. Invaluable. I'm not even talking about the 500 that we care. I'm talking about the 10,000 others that got the paper, were able to keep their asses clear of the draft until it was all over. Me included. Because I was a recipient of those pieces of paper. In fact, I still had them.
So what was this piece of paper? I mean, so what?
Fucking fake draft.
A fake draft card?
You can show any talk.
I see.
Had to have it.
Right. Yeah.
Remember?
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
18 years old.
You had to have it.
Fucking draft card. You didn't have it. Your ass was gone.
So these are for people who didn't register.
Didn't register. Didn't decided not to go.
Yeah.
Whatever reason. And, you know, in my eyes, in my brain, the man saved my life, possibly, and the lives of 15,000-16,000 others.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my eyes, you can't. The risk that he took to do it is. And the fact that he got away with
it. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is. It's really impressive.
Yeah.
It's really impressive.
I guess he did get away with it. He's never done time or anything, so.
Not a minute.
Yeah, pretty good.
Hell of a network.
Yeah.
But I know at least 15,000 draft cards printed.
Really?
In his basement.
Yeah. Not bad.
So there's a commune that saved lives. You know?
That's pretty good.
There's a commune that saved thousands of lives.
Yeah.
Somehow, somewhere, somebody's got to tell that story.
Well, I'm hoping I hook up with him on Tuesday. Supposedly Ramon's working on that.
I don't know what health he's in, but I'll tell you what, you know, he is, the last time I saw Irving was 20 years ago.
Well, he's around, Ramon sees him.
It just blows my mind that he wasn't taken with the AIDS.
Yeah, he's pretty flamboyant, huh?
It just blows my mind that he didn't get that. Oh my. Yeah, he's flamboyant. Little tiny guy.
Yeah.
Little itty bitty guy. I mean, 4 foot nothing. Just little tiny guy. Brains. Everything here. Sharp as a goddamn tack.
Well, do you have any just great tales? Who are, you just mentioned Irving. What about, who are the other people that just are unforgettable? Doing some amazing thing somehow. Lou Gottlieb, I would say, right? I mean,
no, I don't want to. Lou and I are at odds at the moment.
Are you?
Oh, yeah. Really? So, oh. We get this way occasionally. Oh. I mean, I look at Lou as sort of as a father figure, and he looks at me as I don't know. But there are lots of stories about Lou, and I'm sure that you know lots of other people can give you stories about him better than me. There are some good stories about the ranch, but I think they're pretty much chronicled already.
Yeah, there's a lot of material. Yeah.
The Home Free Home book chronicles a lot about the funny things that happened at Morningstar Ranch. I don't know. As for people that stand out in my mind as being the leaders of what I've been through, Ron Thalen would stick out in my mind.
Now he ran Psychedelic Shop, right?
Right.
Did he live communally?
Yes.
Yeah.
He lived the better part of his life communally.
Really?
Yeah. Only I think he's either on his deathbed or dead.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah, I was told just shortly ago that he was
not in such good shape.
What happened to him?
He's got liver cancer.
Ooh, jeez. That's pretty deadly.
He's been fighting it for several years. It's just, I guess, it's finally taking his toll. So I imagine he's fairly well unavailable.
Where did he live? Communally?
Lagunitas.
Lagunitas? What was that?
He just had a big house that he opened up.
So yeah.
Everybody else did in those days.
In Lagunitas?
Yeah, well, it's Lagunitas. It's right there near Lagunitas. Yeah, it's Lagunitas, wasn't it?
Hmm. Was this the same time he was running the psychedelic shop?
Just after. He gave up early. He gave up in the middle of 68. With a lot of views. Have you talked to Sandy Martin?
Nope, I haven't.
Are you done?
I hope so.
She's up in Lake County.
Is she way up? That's up a ways. Yeah. She was involved with Olympali, right?
Yeah, so was I.
Were you? Oh yeah, you were there?
Yeah.
Were you with the Morningstar people that went down there kind of when they got thrown out of Morningstar?
No. I never got thrown out.
Okay.
I refused to get thrown out. I was arrested 3 times. Spent 30 days in contempt court the first time, 60 the second time, 90 the third.
Wow.
Contempt. Hmm. It was the only time I ever had the opportunity to look a judge in the face and say, I ain't got nothing but contempt.
Really? Wow.
You're in contempt court. 90 days!
Wow.
Sauter was his name. Judge fucking Sauter. I guess that's the best. There's a couple of good stories. I remember one time Don and Sandy's dog jumped in a cop car and wouldn't get out. That was a good one. I mean, just would not get out of it. Nothing they could do. They're going to shoot him. 15 naked hippies standing around watching Tripper trip out. You know, Tripper was the name of the dog. We all knew he wasn't coming out of there. No way. The only way you get him out of there was pull another car up beside it, open the door. He'd jump from car to car. That was it. He'd decide he's going for a ride. He's going for a ride. Wouldn't get out of the damn car. That was a funny scene. There's lots of funny scenes, but I'll tell you what. It's a lot more important to me than the funny scenes is the lasting impression. Morningstar Ranch was an idea. It wasn't a place. It doesn't exist in real. It's not there. Even though the land is there, even though Gottman is there, Morningstar Ranch is not there. Period. He can call the land that he's sitting on anything he wants. But the fact is that Morningstar Ranch was an idea. Idea and an ideal. A lot of us will not give up. There are some of us who have, including we've got given up on that idea and that ideal. I, for one, will never give up that idea and ideal.
What is the ideal?
The ideal is to live harmoniously as a voluntary criminal. To use the land as the land wishes to be used, not to impress your own will on it, rather let it impress its will on you. Become a steward rather than an owner. Your stewardship is an entirely different concept than ownership. Open land is the only option the world has, period, bar none. There is no other option. And ultimately, that's the way it's going to be. But for now, we can just all delude ourselves that these little private boundaries that we sit around each little piece of land really mean something. And when in fact they don't. God created the world. God did not create countries with boundaries. He did not create create states with boundaries. He did not create provinces with boundaries. He created one fucking world. Mm. And that's the way it ultimately will be. Right now, the old system is just going through its death throes. The old system of, this is my land and I'll do what the fuck I want, is out. It's gone. It's forever. It'll never come back. Mm. Government restriction, every government restriction that I can think of that is put on private land, I applaud every single one of them, because ultimately what it does is it brings down the system. The system's got to go. Private ownership cannot be allowed on this planet.
It's sure one of the most destructive things on the planet.
It cannot be allowed. It's that simple. Those of us with any brains whatsoever can see that the system of private ownership of land and the wars that come and go because of it, and the slavery that's caused because of it, the total disintegration of peoples that is caused by it, has got to go. We've got to rid it from this planet. We've got to rid it from our minds. We've got to just... You got to think globally, and you got to act locally. Think globally and act locally. And that's where I'm at, is thinking globally and acting. Actually, I'd like to act a little globally, too. I have touches with this computer every single day, all over the world, with people like mine.
Yeah, sure.
And it costs me $12 a month. I love it.
Yeah.
Disseminating the ideas. People don't understand. You know, they came to Morningstar, the press came to Morningstar, and they looked at it, and what they saw was naked young girls running around getting fucked. That's what they saw.
Yeah, it's the press reports.
That's what they saw. You know, you take a look at the Morningstar scrapbook. Ramon and I put that scrapbook together. It took us all 3 months. We had it published in 6 months total, start to finish. We had it done. And it really does chronicle what happened. Whether it's hard to read or just newspaper clippings, it is what it is. It's a scrapbook of ideas. It's a scrapbook of... And it really does put the Morningstar perspective right up front. However, and unfortunately, over time, most of the people who were in that scrapbook have either died literally, or their hearts have been figured.
Somehow.
A lot.
Yeah.
A lot. Hmm. I'm sort of disparaged because I've spent the last 2 years trying to put together a 1997 Hate Street, Rainbow Family, intercommunal gathering for the Summer of Love 1997, 30 years after.
Mm-hmm.
And I have met with so much resistance. I spent 2 years trying. I've given
up. Really? Yeah.
I've given up. It's not going to happen.
Yes.
I really wanted it to happen. Mm. And frankly, I had the connections to pull it off. Mm. But the fact is, the connections are not interesting. Mm. Not interesting. I thought it would be fun just one more time.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be fun. No question about that.
I mean, I can imagine putting what's left of the airplane on stage, what's left of the Grateful Dead on stage, and maybe Peter, Paul, and Mary, and maybe, you know, what's left of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, fuck Woodstock. This is not a money thing. You know, this is a come together and do it, just like a rainbow. Just one day it's not there, the next day it is. And that's what I was shooting at.
Yeah.
But, man, my skull's been dashed against the wall so many times on this one. It's just, I can't do it. I can't pull it off alone.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I can't pull it off alone. It just takes a group effort.
Yeah.
And there's no group effort out there. It's group apathy.
Well, times are different now.
It's group apathy.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, I tried to pull the rainbow people together. I mean, the Morningstar people all together. And that was a fucking fiasco. Believe me, that was a fiasco. If there are any more independent people on the face of this planet than Morningstar people, I do not know who they are. I have no idea, because these people are so independent, they cannot get together for 10 minutes on any one given subject until there is out-and-out brawling.
Jeez.
You know, I mean, maybe that's just because we all live too close together, you know? Maybe it's because we saw each other fucking our old ladies. Whatever, you know, maybe we're so close that we just can't, you know, when we try to put that back together, it's just friction.
That's what Vivian told me. She said there are people, too many people too close together.
That may be it. That may well be it. Because we live on top of each other, basically.
Yeah.
We screwed each other's wives. You know?
Right.
I mean, you could say that.
Well, it happened, but
sure did. Regular basis. Yeah, it was Morningstar. I mean, the other places were considerably different, but all the other communes were a little different than that. Mm-hmm. Morningstar was a blowout. Hardy, hardy.
Yeah. Were psychedelics easily available all the time?
Yeah.
Someone just showed up and there they were.
Well, the Grateful Dead had a lot to do with it. They were strong supporters, and they would just start making money. So them and Chet Helms used to do some of my tours and so we were kind of back by the hippie business community. As an experiment. So the Dead especially like to throw acid and shit. I mean, that was their thing. They would give John bags of acid. And it was all straight from house. So we always had the best. Whether there was any, it was feast and famine. One day, Ramon tells a story. He tells a story about, you know, never having fucking weed at Morningstar. And the reason nobody ever got busted at Morningstar for having drugs is because as soon as they got there, they were gone.
Consumed immediately, huh?
Right. He was pissed off, so he bought like two or three. Pounds of Mexican weed.
Yeah.
And brought it back with him in the absolute assurance that at the end of the day he'd still have some left. You know, 3 or 4 pounds. No way. He did it like 3 or 4 times. It would get smoked up and eat up or shot up or jumped. You know, or shoved up somebody's nose so fast that there was never anything there to get busted for. Because it was all internal at that point.
Right. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, geez.
Oh, my. I had some unbelievably good acid trips. I've taken over 1,000 hits of acid in my life. I'm still here. I don't do acid. I'll show you what I do to you, and I just fucking love them. This is some of the local variety of psilocybin cubianus that's grown in somebody's basement.
Yes.
It's just fucking delicious.
That's great.
You know, it's just top of the line stuff.
As good as any acid in the basement.
Just as
wow. Well, any other tales you'd come to mind?
There's so many.
Yeah, I know that's a problem.
I mean, I've been involved in the community on both sides of the country, in the middle of the country, with the Rainbow family, with the Morningstar, with the Diggers. Intentional communities has pretty much, until lately, had been my life. Until I got married and had kids and did that. I mean, and even today, if I could find an intentional community that I thought would offer me the chance to grow, I'd go for it, even today.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen any lately that do that. You know, what do I want to do? Plant myself in the middle of the woods, you know, with a bunch of people around me who have differing goals, differing values, differing ideas about the way things should be going. I mean, I went down to Steve, to Steve Gaskin's place on several occasions. I could never get into their trip.
Yeah.
You know, I got into some parts of their trip, don't get me wrong, because they had some, there were some ideas, man. I mean, there's some ideas come out of that place that have kept me on the path. Hmm. But as for the actual place and everything that went on there, I then felt I should steer clear, and would still today feel that I need to steer clear. I steer clear away from anything that is one leader. Hmm. When I hear, you know, there's one guy,
yeah,
it's called Father or you know, the boss or anything, mm-hmm, like that, you know, I absolutely have to steer clear of it. That's not what I want to hear about.
Yeah.
I want to hear about the guy that owns the place.
Yeah.
I don't care about the guy who owns the place. I know who owns the place. God owns the place. If they don't like it, and then a human being don't like it, they can suck my dick. Right? You know, I do not care what they think. I know what the truth is. You know, and I've got to look at it that way, because the ultimate destruction of private property in this world has got to happen. And I will push for that for the rest of my life. But it's those boundaries that we erect between our houses, these little picket fences, these cute little white picket fences that we erect between these houses, that is exactly the same boundary that we erect between ourselves and Saddam Hussein, or whoever our current enemy is.
Yeah, right.
And they gotta go. They gotta go. They cannot go on like this. It has reached an impasse. There ain't no more room to divide.
Seems like it, yeah. Let me back up a little bit if I can. I'm just curious, I didn't quite get this straight. How did you hook up with the community service in Ohio? What was the... Where were
I
you?
I lived there.
Oh, you lived in Ohio?
Yeah, I lived 12 miles from Brookville.
Yeah, Yellow Springs, wasn't it?
Well, Yellow Springs was 33 miles from my house. So I spent quite a bit of time in Antioch, which is the college
right
there. Community service, originally, well, they had a big office in Yellow Springs.
They had an office in Yellow Springs.
Yeah.
You know, Brookville, wasn't that where Mildred Loomis was?
Right, yeah,
and
Mildred.
Yeah, so you got to know her when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah, when I was real, yeah.
Really?
I knew her when I was...
And she was doing that Lane's End...
14.
Yeah.
Yeah, 14, 15, right, Lane's End.
Yeah. Huh, so you went out there?
Yeah, well, it was only 10 miles or 12 miles from my house.
Well, that was like a precursor of the 60s communes, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Exactly. So you were out there, and then you got in touch with the people in Yellow Springs and their operation?
Well, you know, I said the hippies started happening. People keep driving by Mildred's place and saying, oh, well, we're going to San Francisco. What's happening? Oh, yeah, lots of people, you know, come on, dig it. The scene's in San Francisco. So we meet a lot of people going from New York to San Francisco stopping in on the way. Some people that stopped in along the way was a couple of years out of Lois Cugini, who came out of New York. She calls herself Podman. I have somebody you can talk to about community. You know, she just lives in... Can't meet her over here.
Who is that?
She calls herself Podman. P-A-D-M-A.
Podman? Is that last name?
Or? No, that's just her name.
Oh, okay.
One name. Podman. Okay. But her real name is Lois... I don't know what her latest name is. Used to be Lois Cugini. Bob and Lois. Bob Cugini. He lives in Creighton.
Okay.
Lois and Bob came to my little town and met a friend of mine, the only hippie I knew, and he was what hippies were beating. He stopped him. They had picked him up hitchhiking, or he had picked him up hitchhiking, or something. And they told me they were going to Morningstar Ranch. Now, that was in 66. Yeah.
So they'd heard about it. They'd heard about it real early then.
They had heard about it early, too. And I had such a delightful time with them, and they turned me on to the first marijuana I ever smoked. And it was so great. Nowhere else around where I live to get it. So So I decided to follow the mountains. That's when I came to San Francisco.
And that was 67?
66.
66? Were you out of high school by then?
No,
I was 16
years.
So, you, I guess...
Just, I did. Yeah, okay. I listened to Larry, you know, and dropped out.
Yeah.
But I was always an avid reader. You know, I could fucking read everything I could get my hands on. I had read, at 16, I had already read Howell, Ginsberg's Howell. Sort of got into the beat side for a bit before the hippie thing started up. It really didn't start up until late 66. The hippie thing, that's when the news media caught hold of it, 66, late 66. 67, the big blitz, the big media blitz.
Excuse me.
Lived in communes in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Oh yeah? What was that? In town?
Yeah, we put a newspaper out. It was called the Tribal Messenger.
Hmm. What did the commune have a name?
Tribal Messenger.
What kind of?
The Tribal Messenger.
Tribal Messenger.
Right, it had a guy by the name of, survived and had that common thread. Everybody got together once a day for me, just like a family. And I think that's the key to intentional communities. I think intentional communities have to be more than people living together. Mm-hmm. I think it has to be a family. And I think that family has to pull together. I think they have to do things that enhance the family's life. Not any one person's, but the family's life. Mm-hmm. The best way to do it is through a gift, the gift of the cooking, the gift of listening, the gift of psychoanalysis, the gift of hammering up the side of your mind, the gift of, you know, I envision a gift economy where instead of buying and selling and going through bartering or this or that or the other thing, things inside the family need to happen from a different level. They need to happen from this level, from the heart, not the level of the greed. As long as that's maintained, as long as there are people willing to give at that level, at the level of the heart, because it needs to be done, then I think you have a viable community that's looking out for itself and others. The one thing that I like about Steve Gaskin's stand, and it really wasn't Steve's stand, it was Ina May, his wife.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that impressed me about her, she came out with a statement one time. blanket statement. I mean, they put it out everywhere. They put it on the news media, they put it in books, they put it everywhere they could put it. They said, if you're a mother and you don't want that baby, all you got to do is come down here, drop him off, and come back and pick him up anytime you want.
It's pretty impressive. Couldn't get a much more general offer than that.
I've done it. My family and I have done it 3 times so far.
Have you really?
Exactly the same thing. We have said, we're here, we're open, you have a problem, the kids are, you can't have the kids right now, leave them here, come back, get them when you want. We've done it ourselves, personally, 3 times.
3 times, wow.
All three times were multiple children.
Wow. That's pretty generous.
We kept two sisters we kept for 2 years, and then my mother took them. Then we just had, just last week, the mother took back 3 kids. We had for about 6 months. And one time before back east. Well. But that, that idea stuck. I said, yeah, that's right. That's one of the things that communities should be good for.
So a basic idea, isn't it? Take care of each other.
Exactly. And so my kids, this one included, have had a life of service themselves, taking care of other little kids that were in trouble.
Yeah.
Around here, kids in trouble is real easy to find. Around here, because there's so much heavy powder use in this area.
Yeah, is there really?
I think you need to throw this away. It's been my life.
I probably ought to get on my way. I got other places to go, unless you have any other.
Well,
we can go for hours, right?
If I knew specifically what you wanted,
This is what I want, just stories of the communes. That's it.
Are you going to publish this electronically, or?
I don't know yet. I'm really, my point immediately is just to get all this material together and make an archive, and then I want to put at least a part of it on the web, let it be available. But I don't know. I haven't worked out details.
I tell you, you've been involved in communities too.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Which one?
Well, nothing you'd ever heard of. I mean, I was out in the Midwest, out where I am now still, Kansas.
You might not.
And, we had our own little situations there, but nothing, Morningstar was famous.
Oh, yeah. Did
you get a copy of this copy? Yeah, Ramon gave me a copy of that. So I've known Ramon for several years.
Have you?
Yeah.
I've known him for several years.
Well, I dare say, a little longer. Yeah.
No, 30. 30.
Close to 30.
Me and Ramon don't see eye to eye on everything either. So.
Yeah.
I see him and that stupid ass brooder ball.
Yeah, well, he's pretty fixated on that.
Oh boy, is he ever. I'll swear.
Yeah, he has pretty legitimate grievance.
Oh, I know. Yeah, he's got a good gripe. God. He carries it a couple of steps too far. I'm sure those people there don't think that they're doing any, causing any harm.
Oh, no. I don't think there's any question. They're not. The basic intention isn't bad.
He actually fears for his life. I don't think he has caused it.
I don't know. They're supposedly pacifists. I hope he's not quite in that dire a condition.
He has said that in the past. I know.
Has he really?
Alan Polly was an interesting. I mean, I could give you some personal anecdotes about Alan Polly.
Yeah, what happened at Alan Polly?
Has anybody talked to you about
Alan Polly? Well, a little bit. Vivian was there.
Vivian wasn't there much.
She said briefly, yeah.
I was, because that's where the fucking ovens were.
The ovens?
Yeah, they had these huge fucking bread ovens.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Grateful Dead. See, Grateful Dead had owned the place.
Oh, they owned it. I
learned. Branded it or something. Yeah. They had control. And they partied in the place for a while until some hippies didn't burnt the fucking place down. Burnt this beautiful mansion right to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Burned it to the ground. And then after that, a guy named Don McCoy
came and took over. Don McCoy was this helicopter pilot, and he made his money flying businessmen from Marin County, you know, Marin Airport or down there, Sausalito.
Yeah.
Well, that was his. And he had made money, his money from flying these guys from there down to the airport every day. So he'd made lots of money. Yeah. And he went in and somebody's, I think it was Sandy Barton, either Sandy Barton or Sheila Hamilton, the gal that he's with now, slipped him some fucking acid. Went dosed his ass.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Really dosed his ass. And between the two of those women, which he, you know, they were both in love with him. Between the two of them, they brought him to the conclusion that he ought to buy this place. They brought him up to Morningstar first, and looked around at Morningstar. And then a few weeks later, he went down there and he bought, or he rented, I guess. He went in and took a lease out on Holland Valley Ranch. It was some ungodly figure at that time, $2,000 a month or so. You know, and at that time, that was just ungodly
money. Yeah.
So anyway, he had this $2,000 a month rent, and they got him so fucking loaded, and they kept him so fucking loaded, that anything anybody wanted in the place, he'd give them money to buy.
Wow.
So people would ride in on a fucking tricycle and ride out on a Harley. You know?
Jeez.
That kind of stuff. Supplied the, you know, anything. It didn't matter what food. If the place needed food, if there were 500 people in the place and you needed food, you just went to them and say, hey man, we need some food. And he'd say, how much? He'd say, $1,000. Write a check.
Amazing.
On the spot. Boom. Yeah. You'd go buy the food. The diggers need some dough for making the mint. I remember he gave me, I think it was two beers. Gave me $2,000 and said for me to stock the bread baking, buy flour and yeast and sugar and all of that shit. So, well, I mean, he had these huge fucking ovens. I mean, you could bake 40 loaves of bread at a time.
Wow!
Right there. So I went and bought it, man, and I bought two trucks. Two quarter ton pickup loads of bread stuff.
Wow.
Wheat berries and raw flour, raw sugar. Went to the health food store to do it.
Yeah?
Wow. The closest health food store in San Rafael to do it. And, I mean, that was the caliber of the place. It was kind of like hippie Wonder, hippie Disneyland. Constantly. Didn't matter what the drug you want. It doesn't matter. No matter what the drug is. It's here. I mean, you want some, take it.
Wow.
Shit, that's amazing. Yeah, that was as close to hippie Disneyland as there could ever be.
You got a millionaire there paying the bills.
And all of them, at will, at whim.
Yeah.
At whim.
Yeah, I wish I could have seen it.
It was amazing. I'll never forget one time, and everybody was so loose. I mean, just so loose. Lou Gottlieb's old lady, Rena.
Yeah.
You know,
he's
talked about her.
I've heard him.
He's talked about her.
Yeah.
She's the wildest woman I ever knew. You know, beyond a shadow of a doubt. One time I walked up to the place in Holland Valley was the way you came in, there was a long lane and then some houses, and that's where the mansion and pool were over there. Other than the communist house, the pool was over there, and then there was the road led on up into the hills. And about halfway up to the top of the hill there was a place they called the Deer Camp. And the Deer Camp had a little, like a shelter house. You know what I'm talking about, a shelter house?
Yeah.
And only it was screened in, it was all screened in, it had a cook shack in it, a regular place to cook. big long tables, and you know, a great place for people to have a meal every day.
Mm-hmm.
You can put, you know, put 200-300 people in there at a shop. So I walked up there, and I was walking up, and I started hearing these noises of walking up. The board covering the shelter house, the windows were down. I'm hearing these noises, and it's obviously a couple making love.
Yeah.
A couple making love. So I get up there, and Don McCoy had his house here, and the shelter house was here, and somebody told me that Rena was with Don, his place. So I went over and knocked on the door at Don's, McCoy's place. And he said, "Hey, come on in." So I came on and asked Rena here. "Oh, I think she's over in the shelter house." So as I'm walking back out, he follows me out the door and he hollers into the shelter house. "Hey, Rena, the fire truck's here. He wants to see you." And she just, without breaking a stroke, just said, "Well, come on in." So I walk on in, and here she is with, I don't know, some guy. And they're on top of the table and just like going to town. And she spent the next 45 minutes talking to me. While she was,
is that right?
While she continued, you know?
So that's pretty wild.
Yeah.
Amazing times.
Those were the days. Blew me away. That's the first time anything like that ever happened to me. You know, I was a kid, Christ, I was 68. I was like 18 years old.
Yeah.
You know? 18.
How come the name
Fairfoot? Well, because that's how I looked, I guess. But they used to wear this big ass serape. Yeah. It's actually an old army blanket.
Hmm.
I used to have it all with me all the time, this big army blanket with a hole cut in the center of it. So when I put it on, it looked like I had trappings of a priest trap. Long throat.
What's your real name?
Steve.
Steve?
Oh.
Is that the net? Is that Stevens?
Yeah, Stevens. That's, you know, Stephen S. is what it is.
Stephen.
Steve Stein.
What's your last name?
Stein.
Stein. Okay.
Same as Sandy.
Oh, same as Sandy. Yeah,
that's cool. We were married.
Oh, yeah. I've actually been told that.
Well, actually, her last name is still Stein.
Not for long.
Well, what's your real last name?
Stein.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Her name was Stein before I married her.
Was it really?
Yeah, it's S-T-E-I-N. I spelled mine S-T-I-N-E.
Is that right?
So just two different spellings.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. I need to get on my way. I have one formality I hate to bother you with, but we have to get people's permission to archive this. Essentially, it's permission to be quoted. Let's just say people can look at this. What they want to go out of it.
Department of